This week on Pop of Culture, we take you behind the Potter's Wheel.
I just really enjoy most of all about the pottery community is that it is such a sharing and community building medium.
We preview an event in the neighborhood.
So we have neighbors who help us in our community to be better. And so we help kids see that by seeing who's around.
And we'll visit an art museum. Coming up,
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations, and by sustaining members of IPR. Become a member today at indianapublicradio.org.
From Indiana Public Radio, this is Pop of Culture. I'm Jen Blackmer.
And I'm Kara Duquette. We're going to start today behind the wheel. What wheel, you might ask? The Potter's Wheel. Sarah Richcreek is a production potter with over 10 years of experience and a business of her own that exemplifies her precision and wheel throwing skills. She is a BSU alum and a teacher at heart. Her teaching experience spans from wheel-thrown pottery to silversmithing to open-fire cooking, baking, and yoga. Sarah, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Can you share with us a little bit about your artist journey, your work, and your business?
Yes, absolutely. Well, I think I have to start by saying that I was really lucky to have been born into a family who was really open to, like, when my parents said I could do anything, they were really being honest. So I went to school for art, and I went to school with a lot of other kids whose parents did not support them. So I came from a really supportive household, and that's I'm really grateful for. But so I went to Ball State, and I was actually my focus was metalsmithing. And under Pat Nelson, and I enjoyed it very much, but I kept gravitating over towards the ceramic studio. So I basically double majored. If that was a possibility, I would have done it in ceramics, because I just really enjoyed how, like, the metalsmithing portion, when you're working on one project, it takes so long, and it looks like it was, you know, had spent a lifetime under the sea until the very end when you polish it all up. Whereas, like, pottery was so instantly, like, gratifying and finished, and just, it was, like, much more quickly completed, and that was very satisfying when a single project in metalsmithing took so long. And then after college, I graduated right into the recession of 08. So nobody was really interested in jewelry at the time. I did teach at the Indianapolis Art Center, jewelry making, for a couple of years. And that was really, really fun. That's where I cut my teeth, teaching. Mm-hmm. And I was actually a bench jeweler for a couple of years after college as well. And then I just found that metalsmithing just wasn't what I was kind of looking for. I wound up working at Connor Prairie starting in 2012, and it was there where I intended to learn more about, like, farming and homesteading, but then I got reintroduced to pottery, and that was what I didn't really know that I needed, and I've been a potter ever since.
I don't know. It kind of sounds like you have always kind of known that you needed pottery, just because you said you kept gravitating towards it.
Yeah. Yeah, there's just something so soothing about it. There's something so grounding. I think that's the best word for it. It's a very primal experience. Like, you're literally playing with mud and dirt, and you're using water, and you harden it with fire. And it's just, I don't know. Primal is the best word for it. Makes me feel really connected to tradition and to, like, ancestry. Mm-hmm. And that's something that Connor Prairie, my time there at Connor Prairie, really instilled in me too, such a great appreciation for tradition and lineage. I kind of feel like almost a Luddite, because during the pandemic, everybody started taking interest in pottery, which is wonderful, but because everybody was homebound, they were searching the internet for how-to videos and all that stuff. And YouTube and the internet is great in its own way. But I just am so proud of the people who I learned how to make pottery from. So I started with like Vance Bell and Ted Neal. And then I moved to Connor Prairie, where there was Gary Pascal and Larry Gillum. And these potters are fantastic. And then I've always had John Peterson as an influence as well. And my dad is a potter. So he and I kind of like have a lot of friendly competition. But yeah, so I just think that that's what makes me be a proud teacher too, is because I love that connection that I had with my teachers, and I aspire to make that same connection with my students.
Well, when you were at Connor Prairie, what was your role with pottery there?
I wore a lot of hats there, but with pottery, mm-hmm. I was one of the costumed interpreters. So I would be in the 1836 village dressed up like in full 1836 garb. So like layers and layers and layers of clothing, like petticoats and a bonnet. And I was in the pottery shop in like on a kick wheel, like a 200-pound old-fashioned wheel. And it's still kind of used in various forms across the world, but it is foot powered. So you're basically sitting at a wheel, at a heavy wheel at the bottom, which is what your foot kicks to propel the tiny wheel at top. And the tiny wheel at top is where you throw the pottery. So you turn the clay on top of that. And because of the weight of the wheel at the bottom, centrifugal force will get going and then it'll spin for a good amount of time. But you do have to get it started. And then if you need to stop suddenly, like if you mess up or something, you have to stomp on the wheel, the bottom one. And then, you know, potter wheels these days, they just have little engines and a little foot pedal like you have in your car or on your lawnmower, and it's, or a go-kart, you know, just on and off. And it's so much easier. But I will admit that I love using a kick wheel more because it's got a beautiful whirring sound versus like a mechanical sound with modern pottery wheels. And I would do demonstrations for folks who came in, and I would talk about the history of pottery, and I would be in first person. So I had to pretend like I was actually the potter's daughter, and I had to talk about, you know, it was very unusual to see a woman in a pottery shop because that was man's work. And then I would help with the kiln burns, and behind the scenes, I would help make pottery for like the gift shop. And I would teach classes there too.
How wonderful is that? You were talking about like the lineage, the history of pottery. You have all these wonderful mentors, including your father. And then you get to like be in 1836.
Yeah, it was pretty great. Yeah, I was there for 10 years. It was wonderful.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about, I hear that you are a production potter, and I'm not entirely sure what that means. Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, so when my time at Connor Prairie was over, I moved on to take a job with Graves Co. So Rebecca Graves of Graves Co. hired me to be one of her production potters. And at the time, her business was built of like maybe a dozen of us who had different jobs in the little industry that we were doing there. So there were four production potters, and I was one of those, which is to say I took whatever cup or design that she wanted and I just replicated it, and I made thousands of pots for her. Wow. So like my first year there, I counted, I made over 18,000 pots for her. And 18,000, not 1,800. Yeah. So and it is just, you're just a little clay machine. That's all you are. And like, I really enjoyed my time there too, because the team was so like quirky and wonderful, and I'm still really close with them. And I was at Graves Co. for 2 years. And so because of that, I got really efficient and I got really good at making pottery. And it's something that I'm proud to say.
I was going to ask you if that time helped you with like your studio pottery work. Do you have a pottery studio of your own?
Yeah. So when I moved on from Graves Co., I moved into a rental, and this space has enough space for my home studio. So I collected equipment, and I had a lot of help from my boyfriend, and we insulated it, and it's a fully functional studio in just off of my garage. And I share it with another potter, one of my friends from Graves Co., who I met at Graves Co. And we just have a little pottery production space, and it's so much fun. And I'm very lucky, because not a lot of people can say that they've got their fully functional space. Like, they might have a wheel, but not a kiln. So I've got the whole shebang.
Yeah, that's so one of the things that a lot of people lose after they're done with school, right? The facility to continue their art.
Absolutely.
Now, do you throw and hand build, or what does your process look like a little bit? Can you tell
us? I'm primarily a thrower. Yeah, because of all of my production time with other places, I am just really fast, and that's my favorite part. And so I focus primarily on throwing really nice functional pieces. Like, I don't do a lot of decorative work, and that is for one, I was never that really great at illustration. I don't have a whole lot of patience for like painting and stuff like that. So my focus has been drawn towards the ergonomics of the thing that I'm making. Like, I want my pottery to be so comfortable in the hand and against the lip that it's almost like you don't even notice it.
I love that, form and function together.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the best.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let me ask you what your favorite thing to throw is. Or do you have one?
I do. I really made some fun planters about a month ago, and I altered the rim. I kind of did a little pinched rim situation, and so I pinched them all the way through so that there was like a little loop on the side, and then I threaded twine through those holes to make like a suspended planter. So those were really fun. But the thing that I like to make most of, I think, is mugs. I just like a mug. I'm a mug person. I like to collect mugs. I like to make mugs. I like to drink out of them, you know.
Well, is there somewhere that we can find you and your work, some mugs or other things online?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram. You can find me at mimeo.tableware. I'm on Facebook too, I will admit. I'm a little bit bored with Facebook, so I don't post Facebook very often, but I'm on Etsy as well, and you can find me anywhere. Yeah, like Mimeo Tableware, M-I-M-E-O Tableware.
Okay, that's wonderful. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. And was there anything else that you'd like to tell us about your art?
I think the importance is less, I shouldn't say this as a business owner, but I think the importance is less on my work, but I think the connection that I have with my students. I teach at a studio locally here, and I just really enjoy most of all about the pottery community is that it is such a sharing and community building medium. And I don't know why pottery is different than painting and drawing. I think it's because you have to have a lot of help, like firing kilns, and there's so much nuance and so much information across the board with pottery that you need mentors, you need friends to help you be successful. And I just love being a part of it.
Well, I think that's great. It does. It brings a community together to get the job done. And yeah. It sounds like you have a real nice symbiotic relationship between, you know, your work in your studio and your teaching. So thank you so much for sharing with us today.
Yeah, well, thanks for inviting me. It's been really nice.
Sarah Rich Creek is a potter and yoga instructor residing in Indianapolis.
The Pop of Culture team is always working to keep you updated on events for all ages this summer. Our producer, Luke Jones, spoke to the curator of one event happening this weekend.
My name is Ashley Mann, and I'm the Community Engagement Manager at Ball State PBS.
And what exactly does that mean, Ashley?
That means that I go out in the community and we do events in small programs or large ones, depending on the topic or the day, ranging from hour-long programs at the library focused on literacy and computational thinking, or events like Be My Neighbor Day, which are much larger in scale.
And you just mentioned Be My Neighbor Day, so tell us, what is Be My Neighbor Day?
Be My Neighbor Day is a fantastic free event for families. And at the event, we have all kinds of organizations who come and are our neighbors and show us how to be good neighbors in lots of different ways. We focus on nonprofits in the community that have offerings for the families that attend the event, whether that be the Second Harvest or Minnetrista or Ball State PBS.
So I've never been to Be My Neighbor Day, but I understand it's set up basically like a neighborhood. Can you kind of take us through that neighborhood, like what it'll be like as you walk through, what kids will see, what they'll be able to do?
Sure. So you come through the neighborhood and you enter at the welcome space and you get your tote and you get a program that tells you who you're going to see that day in the neighborhood. So the children and the families can go around and they can do activities at all the different neighbors' booths and just have a good time together. In addition, we have a meet and greet with Daniel Tiger, which who doesn't love that? And some live music and some fancy drinks and food available at the food trucks.
Nice. So I know Daniel Tiger is a show on PBS Kids, Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood. I have not watched it because I don't have small children. Can you tell me a little bit more about what the show and what it's about and what Daniel Tiger represents?
Absolutely. Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood is a great show that sort of spins off of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood for those who may be around my age, and carries on a lot of the same principles. So being a good person, being kind to your neighbor, working together, and just teaching kids some basic lessons while they're enjoying their friends in the neighborhood.
So you've mentioned a couple times that we're trying to, part of the event is teaching how to be a good neighbor. How does that happen? Like, how are you doing that in an event?
So how to be a good neighbor is to take care of each other. How to be a good neighbor is to be kind to those around you, even those you don't know or maybe different than you. How to be a good neighbor is offering assistance. And so all of those things come through in a maybe not so overt way in Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood and in Be My Neighbor Day. So we have neighbors who keep us safe. The police officers will be there. We have neighbors who help us to have food. The food bank will be there. We have neighbors who help us find fun things to do. We have museums or the theater or the ballet. We have neighbors who help us be healthy. Open Door Health will be there. So we have neighbors who help us in our community to be better. And so we help kids see that by seeing who's around.
Nice. So let's talk logistics. Where, when, how do people get there? Where do they park the minivans?
Fair. So this year we have made the decision, due to extreme heat that is forecasted, to move inside away from Cannon Commons and to Inspire Academy. Which we're pretty excited about. We'll be inside the gym at Inspire Academy, which means that there will be parking on both sides of the school, and there'll be some signage to let you know where to come in. And then we'll just be set up in there. So logistics, come park in the parking lot and walk in. It's from 1 to 4 on Saturday, June 22nd, and we are just hoping to have a great time in a cooler location, pun intended.
Is there any sort of registration required ahead of time?
There is not. This is a free event for families, and we just hope that they come and have a great time together.
Do you have to be the, like, one or two, or can you show up at, like, 3:30.
You can come and go as you please and take as long as you want. I would say 3:30 may be a little bit late to see the whole thing, but mm-hmm. if your goal is just to see one or two things, then that would be fine too.
Yeah. Is there a particular age group that this event would suit best?
So Daniel Tiger is meant for the younger end of our PBS Kids families. So probably 2 years to five or six, maybe, up until I would say school age would be perfect. And then, of course, their siblings and their parents as well are always welcome.
Well, sure. Yeah. It's for the whole family, right?
Yes.
What other, because I know you're always working on events, do you have other things that you're looking forward to this year?
Sure. So we have some events coming up at Marion Hunt Library on Mondays for Music and Movement Time. Those are hour-long programs with some activities and some take-home things afterward. We also will, at the end of summer slash the beginning of the school year in August, we will have Family and Community Learning Nights. Mm. That's a series of four events in the evenings that families would have to register for. If people are interested, feel free to contact me at the station.
How do people contact you if they need to get if they want to get a hold of you?
They can email me at ashley.mann@bsu.edu, and that's probably the best way to do it.
Gotcha. What if they want more information about Be My Neighbor Day?
Also email me at ashley.mann@bsu.edu or check out the event on Facebook. That's where we will do the most up-to-date updates.
Gotcha. And it's man with two N's, right?
Two N's, correct.
All right. Is there anything else we should know about Be My Neighbor Day or the work that you're doing for PBS Kids in the community?
Just know that Be My Neighbor Day is going to be really fun. Even though we have moved locations, it still should be a great time. And every kid gets to go home with a certificate saying that they know more about their community and that they can be a good neighbor. And they get a free book with some activities to go home as well.
We should all try and be better neighbors.
Agreed.
Ashley, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Be My Neighbor Day is a Ball State PBS event. Ball State PBS and IPR are a part of Ball State Public Media. Next week, the Evansville Museum of Arts, History, and Science will unveil a glass mosaic from Pablo Picasso that it's had in storage unknowingly since the 1960s. From WNIN in Evansville, John Gibson explains what happened and when you can see the work.
Seated Woman in Red Hat was created in the mid-1950s at a studio in France where Picasso worked with glass artisans to reinterpret some of his most famous paintings. Industrial designer Raymond Loewy bought Seated Woman in a Red Hat and donated it to the Evansville Museum in 1963. The Picasso piece was in storage at the museum for decades. It was not believed to be a Picasso. But in 2012, experts determined it had been mislabeled, actually bore the signature of the famous artist, and was likely worth millions of dollars. It's been kept at an undisclosed location ever since. Officials say the Picasso will be displayed with other major works of art that will include several Picasso prints and one ceramic work by the artist, in the museum's permanent collection. Museum Executive Director Mary Bauer says she's excited to finally showcase what she calls an exceptional Picasso artwork to tri-state residents and visitors from across the United States. Bauer says the first look will be for museum members June 23rd through the 25th. The new Picasso exhibit will open to the general public with a ribbon cutting by Mayor Stephanie Terry on Wednesday, June 26th. I'm John Gibson.
John reported from WNIN in Evansville. WNIN and IPR are Indiana Public Broadcasting member stations. I'm Luke Jones.
I'm Kara Duquette.
And I'm Jen Blackmer.
The David Owsley Museum of Art in Muncie has extended its exhibition of Beyond the Medici, the Hakul Family Collection.
That is excellent news for those of us, like me, who haven't had the chance yet to see the exhibition. My travel schedule has been a little crazy this spring.
Oh, you are going to enjoy it so much. It's amazing.
This vibrant collection highlights the skill of Italian artists in the 17th and early 18th centuries.
Do yourself a favor and go see the collection through June 29th. We spoke to Dr. Robert G. LaFrance, director and curator of the museum, back in February.
I want to ask you, why Muncie? What brought you to the David Owsley Museum of Art?
Well, there's really three things that kind of jump out at me right now. First off is simply the collection. I came and visited Muncie, it must have been in the fall of 2013, and I was immediately astounded by what I saw, that we could have such a wonderful collection hidden away here in Muncie, kind of off of the main route, and I said, I need to do something about that. The second thing was it was a great opportunity to work with a major lifelong collector, David T. Owsley. Mm-hmm. I mean, as you probably know, David T. Owsley is the grandson of Frank C. Ball, so there's a relationship with Ball State. He was also a curator at an art museum, at several actually, and then he later became just a collector and an appraiser and lives in New York City. In fact, he lives in my old neighborhood in New York City. So it worked out really well that I could work directly with David Owsley in his collecting. And then another reason, and I'm sure I can come up with many more, is I'm really a Midwesterner at heart. I was born in Ohio, but I was raised in L.A., and I lived many years in New York and in Florence and in Rome and in Washington, D.C. and Champaign-Urbana. So I've lived around many places, but it really meant a lot to me to come back here to the heartland and make my contribution to culture.
That's really pretty wonderful. There's so much going on here in the Midwest, and for you to want to further that is what we love here. Can you tell us a bit more about the work that you've done at the DOMA over time and maybe share some milestones that have occurred in the last decade?
When I came here in 2014, I had just finished my second book, and I published an article shortly thereafter in the Renaissance Quarterly, which is kind of the journal of record for my field. And I really felt I was at a point in my career and I needed to take on a big challenge. So arrived here and I thought, this staff is wonderful. Let's build up the staff. And as soon as we did that, we were able to present over 10 years, 33 exhibitions, which I think is an astounding number for such a small staff. And they range from contemporary global art to African-American art, Mexican modernists, women artists. We've even done a show about gender-based violence. And it's allowed us to connect the David Owsley Museum of Art, DOMA, as we like to call it, to places like the World Bank Art Program, the Diebenkorn Foundation in Berkeley, and many others. So I think all those things are milestones. Plus, we put on hundreds of programs, literally hundreds of public programs in the last 10 years. And that really connects us to the community and the student body. There are many more milestones in this, but for me, these are really important things that have happened. It's kind of the everyday, always putting out an exhibition, making sure there's always going to be the next exhibition, there's the next program, there's the next kind of public engagement.
Is there a lot of traffic from the community and the students at Ball State in the DOMA?
Well, at DOMA, we do have quite a few students that come through. I mean, I like to say we have a captive audience of students here on campus. But I still find students that haven't been here. So we started doing programs with the College of Fine Arts where they do their orientation here. All the College of Fine Arts majors do their orientation at the museum, which I think is a great introduction. A lot of classes require that you come to the museum. We like that very much, too. And so we have that captive audience. The community can be a little more difficult to get them onto campus, period. A lot of people in this community don't feel welcomed on campus for various reasons. A beautiful building like this is such a treasure, and we're free every day. You can come and visit. It's all yours to enjoy. Yes. But others are afraid they can't find a place to park on campus, for example. So there's still barriers out there, although we've taken away the main barrier, which is financial, that yes. We have free admission. And we try to be open as much as we can. Remember, we're open 5 days a week, Tuesday through Saturday. But I would love to invite more people from the public in from East Central Indiana, because that's our region. We are the art museum, the main art museum in East Central Indiana.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the things they might see or how they might, what they might experience if they come to visit?
Well, we have an amazing world art collection. And that, you know, if there's such a thing as a vision, or if I could present a vision of the places, when I arrived in 2014, it was clear to me, it seemed like common sense at the time, that after a number of gifts had been given by mostly by David T. Owsley of works of art from all around the globe, that this museum had transformed itself from one that was kind of a sleepy regional museum into a museum that had works of art representing all seven continents. So this kind of world art museum where people can come here, and we have really the goal that one day every Ball State student's culture could be represented here in this museum. So it's a place for students to come and connect to their culture. It's also a place for people from the community to do the same. And for many, I like to call the museum often a front porch for the university. This is a place that's free and open to the public. You can drive up, and there are metered parking spaces, so you can manage that. And there's also a parking lot, also metered during the day, but on the weekends it's free parking. Don't forget that.
Yes.
You can enter the university in this open space, accessible space, see some wonderful cultural objects that may connect you to your past and your heritage, and then kind of enter into the rest of the university's cultural corridor. We're part of a larger kind of constellation of cultural offerings here at Ball State. There's the Orchid Garden, the Glick Glass Center for Glass. There's Christie Woods. We have Sursa Hall, of course, and Emmons. And now we have a new outdoor amphitheater as well as a planetarium. So try to keep all those in mind. We have several cultural amenities here that much larger cities do not have. So I hope you'll come and see them.
And the museum was initially conceived of by a group of women, a women's organization?
An idea for a museum, you could trace it all the way back in Muncie to the 1890s. There was something called the Art Students League. They were all students of a group of Impressionist painters that kind of worked around a guy named J. Otis Adams here in town. But at that time in the 1890s, these ladies decided that we should start a collection. And they started a collection, and it eventually transmogrified over time because there were different versions of it. And it started a collection that became the collection here at Ball State. The big impetus, though, however, was after 1918, when the university was named Ball State University, had other names before, after the Ball family, Frank C. Ball decided to lend his personal collection. And that really amplified the art collection here.
Well, it's a beautiful museum, and there are so many different styles of art throughout the museum.
Yeah.
And it's for those who've been to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, it has a bit of a smaller version of that vibe. And also, I wanted to ask you, there's a new exhibit, I hear, that's coming to the DOMA, and could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. The new exhibition is called Beyond the Medici, the Hal Cole Collection. I'd like everyone to come and see it, of course. The main topic here is Florentine Baroque art, which is really an understudied area in the history of art. Most general surveys, the art history class you take in college, it kind of jumps from the Renaissance in Florence to the artists of Rome in the Baroque period. However, they didn't close up shop in Florence during the 17th century and move to Rome. There were some really interesting things happening in Florence. There was a real flowering of music and the sciences in the 17th century. That's Galileo's period, for example. Galileo and the invention of the telescope. And Galileo was protected by the Medici family. So that's all happening in Florence, but there's also a group of Florentine artists who are creating this really powerful, rich, robust, colorful, emotional art, which you're going to see in this show. Another point about this show that's really important is the frames, or are the frames. The frames are over-the-top Baroque frames. Gold, ebony, carved figures, inset with semi-precious stones. These frames often are just as good as the works and paintings that are in between the frames.
Wow.
But at our venue, we're going to mix the Florentine Baroque art with European Baroque music. And we're trying to build a more immersive experience.
Sounds like it's going to be a feast of sight and sound here at the DOMA.
That's the idea.
Dr. Robert G. LaFrance is the director and curator of the David Owsley Museum of Art. We spoke to him inside the museum back in February. I'm Kara Duquette.
And I'm Jen Blackmer. Kara, we've reached the part of our show where we ask a local artist, Weiwo, what are you working on?
We're here today with crochet artist Dawn Goff, and we want to find out, Weiwo, what are you working on, Dawn?
I am working on a zillion things. I am currently a vendor at the Minnetrista Market, and so making all kinds of tank tops and sweaters and scrunchies and headbands and made out of crochet, totally crochet.
Oh, that's wonderful. Sounds like a lot of summer gear.
Very much.
So can you describe one of the tank tops you mentioned?
I have a tank top that's kind of hippie. It's got retro daisies on the front and angles down on the side. The current ones I'm working on are like neon rainbow colors with a whole bunch of fringe on the bottom. I had a friend comment and say that it was more of like a music festival shirt where you're shaking around and all the fringe shakes around. So that's what I'm currently working on.
Okay. That sounds like something that can be useful for the summer music series here.
Absolutely. Yes.
In Muncie or wherever you're listening to music.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So there is something that I saw in your booth at Minnetrista that I found very interesting, and it was a plant.
My hanging plant. Yes.
Crocheted.
It was a crochet hanging plant. Yes. I'm in the works to make more of those with interchangeable plants that come out of the hanger. So you can change them out for whatever you feel today or a holiday. You can put a poinsettia in there if you want. That's one of the fun things I'm working on as well.
So where do you get your plant inspiration?
I am also a plant lady. I have 42 plants in my bedroom alone. So, yes, all live plants, love them of all. And so, you know, if one dies, you go, I wish I had that again. And you just learn how to crochet it.
That's fabulous.
That's fun.
Well, what attracted you to crocheting at first?
My grandma taught me how to knit when I was a child.
Okay, you said knit. Okay,
knit, so. Yes. And then when I met my husband, the very first day I went to meet his parents, his mother was crocheting on the couch. And I said, I've never learned how to do that. And she said, sit down here beside me and learn. And that afternoon I learned, and I went home that night and crocheted a blanket.
That's pretty amazing. Can you share with us a little bit about the differences between knitting and crocheting?
I wish I could tell you a whole lot. crocheting, you can do a lot more, in my experience, different techniques, different textures, different designs, just in the stitch that you use. Crocheting works up way faster than knitting. People are more familiar with like blankets being crocheted because they tend to be, you can knit lighter, you can knit, or you can crochet with heavy yarn and make a nice big comfy blanket or sweater or something like that.
Okay. Well, what kind of things do you like to make when you crochet?
Stuff you can wear. and that's new to me because I've always been, I've done the baskets and the dishcloths and the blankets and stuff. But when I learned about a sweater, I was turned on. And cardigans are my favorite. I live in cardigans in the winter, fall. So you can do any color, any size, any length, short sleeve, long sleeve. Currently, I'm doing a lot of, everybody's probably familiar with the traditional granny square that grandmas used to make. You can turn that into anything. So I've made a waistcoat. I've made halter tops. I've made skirts. I've made vests, sweater, just all kinds of stuff. So it's just fun to do and wear and see other people do it too.
Now, for those of us who don't know about the granny square, what does that look like?
A square. But it starts in the center, and it just gets bigger as it goes, and it just looks like a square. And then you make a whole bunch of squares, and you sew them together to make whatever you want.
Beautiful.
I live in a cardigan myself in the fall and the winter. And recently I saw your work at Minnetrista Morning Market, and I saw a lot of really vibrant colors. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about your color sensibility and some of the yarns you use.
Okay. In the winter, I normally do earth tone colors. I'm a hippie at heart, very barefoot all the time. So I like earthy colors, so greens, browns, that kind of thing in the winter. In the summer, real lightweight cotton. This year, I'm doing a lot of vibrant colors, as you said. I'm doing a lot right now of like rainbow patterns, specifically for Pride Month. Just kind of get that out there. But I have younger daughters as well. They're in their mid-30s, who like to wear fun designs and fun colors. And so it's a good way to show off your personality that way. So it's fun. I mean, it's way fun to like change colors and look at how the colors are coming together and how bright they are and how happy it makes you just looking at those. So yeah, that's what I like.
That's one of the things that attracted me to your area. That was this peace and love vibe was coming from your being.
Yeah, I like that. That was my very first one ever. My first ever market, ever being out in public with my stuff.
Wonderful. Yeah. So do you plan to do more of that?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, I am.
Well, is there places that we can find your work online in person?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram and Facebook, Dawn Renee Crochet. I don't have a place to purchase yet. My daughter is on my tail to get that done. But anybody who wants to email me and say, hey, you know, I really want to commission you to make me this in this color for this event or whatever, I'll absolutely do it. I love doing stuff like that.
Ooh. Well, that's pretty, that's tantalizing. You do commissions.
You give me a call.
So what's your email address?
Dawn.Renee, R-E-N-E-E, .crochet@gmail.com.
Okay. Well, now, are there some other things you'd like to tell us about crochet, your art?
I can tell you that most of my life, it has been crocheting pieces for family or friends. For birthdays, Christmas, holidays, things like that. And then my daughter, who is a jewelry maker out in Oregon, kind of pushed me to step out of my comfort zone and do some crochet for public sale. And once I started doing that, I absolutely fell in love. I don't have enough time to crochet. What I would love to do is to do it enough and sell enough that I could quit my regular corporate job and then just crochet for a living. That would be awesome. Out on my back porch on my rocking chair with my glass of iced tea, and I'd be good.
And so you say you like to crochet outside on the porch.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do in the winter?
Crochet inside with a cup of coffee.
So anywhere, a good place,
yes,
to crochet.
Anywhere. Yes, ma'am. That is absolutely true.
Well, will we be able to find you at the Minnetrista Market?
Yes, I will be there once a month because I just kind of stuck my toe in.
Wonderful. Well, we really appreciate you being here today, Dawn.
Well, thank you for having me. This was fun.
Good.
It's that time of the week, Kara. We're going to talk about all the cool things happening this week and here in East Central Indiana. And we're starting with Minnetrista Museum and Gardens in Muncie. It has a new exhibition from a global photography competition, Bird Photographer of the Year. I'm totally obsessed with birds. I will totally be there. To celebrate, they're taking a guided bird watching walk down Minnetrista Boulevard on Wednesday, June 26th from 6 to 7 p.m. You'll spot the various bird species inhabiting our local waterways and learn about conservation efforts. The deadline to register is the day before, Tuesday, June 25th. I'm writing it down. And you can register online at minnetrista.net.
And I know that you are writing that down because we were just talking about how wonderful it is right now. I have a bird nest. Oh, it's fabulous.
It's great. It's like appointment watching, right? Mm-hmm. Like they say, it's appointment television here. It's appointment bird nest watching.
You get to watch them grow and
Take off. It's fab. Also at Minnetrista this week, the Hoosier Shakespeare Festival. Saturday, June 22nd, Romeo and Juliet will be on stage, followed on June 23rd by A Midsummer Night's Dream. Next week, the Hoosier Shakespeare Festival will be performing at Weiler Plaza in Hartford City, June 24th and 25th. All shows begin at 7:30 p.m. More information at Hoosier Shakes. That's shakes.com.
There are multiple venues. Speaking of shakes, there are those kinds of shakes, right? Shake your booty. Can I say booty?
You just did.
Okay, back up. There are multiple venues with live music on Friday, June 21st. They include Blues Under Fire will perform at Psalms Smokehouse in Pendleton at 7:30 p.m. Magnolia Soul takes the stage at Dickman Town Center in Anderson at 7:30 p.m. And 45 RPM will spin up at the Civic Green in Yorktown also at 7:30 p.m. Lots of dancing, lots of music, lots of shakes.
If you plan on seeing the new Disney Pixar film Inside Out 2, but want a different venue, the 1324 Drive-In in Wabash will be showing the film Friday, June 21st, and Saturday, June 22nd at 9:45 p.m. A little past bedtime, but the sun has to set first.
Did you ever see drive-in movies as a kid?
Totally did.
I loved it. It was one of my favorite things to do in the summer, and they're still around, so definitely check that out. And finally, here's something a little different. Ball State's Civic Learning Symposium has extended their deadline for proposals of presentations, discussions, and trainings to June 28th to accommodate demand. Proposals are now due next Friday, June 28th, and you can submit by going to bsu.edu and searching Civic Learning. The symposium is the last week of September 2024, and this is an excellent example of an unusual way to spend some time and learn some great stuff here in East Central Indiana.
Do you have an event to add to our arts calendar? Let us know at indianapublicradio.org.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations, and by sustaining members of IPR. Become a member today at indianapublicradio.org.
And that's our show. This week was produced by Luke Jones, who always makes it a beautiful day in the neighborhood.
Oh.
Hey, Luke.
Yes?
Please, won't you be my neighbor?
Kara, anyone that cares in the community is our neighbor. I'd love to be your neighbor.
Aww.
Our show this week was hosted by me, Kara Duquette.
And me, Jen Blackmer. Pop of Culture is a production of Indiana Public Radio on the campus of Ball State University.